Just start the recording button. Can everybody hear me? Just put yes in the chat box. I would appreciate it. Excellent. Alrighty. Again, this month's Intel Hub presentation is entitled Disrupt and Deny the British Covert Action and Foreign Policy. I am very pleased and honored to welcome our guest speaker today, Dr. Rory Cormick, who is an Associate Professor of International Relations at the University of Nottingham in the UK. His research specializes in covert action and secret intelligence. Dr. Cormott is a fellow in a Roy Historical Society and has held AHRC and Lever Hume research fellowships, and most recently as a visiting scholar at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Cormack has published a wide variety of publications on intelligence and security issue and appears regularly on the media. His most recent book is Disrupt and Deny, Spies, Special Forces, and the Secret Pursuit of British Foreign Policy, published by Oxford Press in 2018. I wish you all join me in welcoming Dr. Cormack, and it is all yours, sir. I'll advance the slides as we go forward.
DC, thank you very much indeed, and good afternoon slash good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I'm going to talk for about half an hour, 35 minutes, about covert action and the British approach to covert action, and then that should hopefully leave plenty of time for questions and a discussion. So, DC, if you wouldn't mind doing the honours, please. When we think about covert action, we think about primarily American activity and American definitions. This one's from Title 50 of the US Code, but it also appears in Executive Order E12333. And it says covert action is activity to influence political, economic, or military conditions abroad where it is intended that the role of the United States government will not be apparent or acknowledged publicly. So we're talking, as we all know, about means of executing foreign policy, including influence operations, propaganda at one end of the spectrum, political interventions, interference, coups, political funding of covert political funding of political parties, all the way through to the other end of the spectrum, the extremes of targeted killing, sabotage, kidnapping, which is obviously used a lot more rarely than influence and propaganda operations. Next slide, please, DC. And generally, we see this as the more active side of intelligence, when, and often done by intelligence actors, instead of watching and gathering intelligence, they're going out and they're trying to influence conditions overseas. It is widely described as deniable. The phrase plausible deniability is widely associated with covert action, because unlike normal intelligence operations, the outcome of the operation is visible. When there is a coup and there's a sponsorship of a coup, the outcome of the coup is visible, but the sponsorship is deniable. And a lot of our understanding of covert action derives from this idea that the hand sponsoring the action has to remain plausibly deniable. That's been critiqued recently. Exposure doesn't always mean failure, and we'll come on to that later. But a key way of understanding covert action is that it is unacknowledged activity to influence conditions overseas. Now, I am a historian of British foreign policy. That's my specialism in British intelligence. But I do love looking at the American side of things, because the American government writes stuff down in a way that Britain really doesn't. And there's no UK equivalent of various American definitions of covert action. Britain uses the phrase covert action, but it also uses various euphemisms, including special operations, special political action, counter subversion, counter action, effect operations, kinetic action. The list goes on, and they're never particularly well defined at all. It's much more fluid. Covert action in Britain is done by SIS, MI6, the Secret Intelligence Service, but the boundaries between that and paramilitary operations that are done by special forces are much more blurred than, at least theoretically, they are in America anyway. So there's no great British definition of covert action. Next slide, please, DC. When we're talking about covert action, it's important to remember that this is a foreign policy choice. It's important to try and demystify covert action because, by its nature, it often gets mythologized to an extent. And if we think of it as a policy choice, as a means of executing foreign policy, covert action is not a policy in its own right. It is a means of executing foreign policy. And it's often used in conjunction with open foreign policy. It's used as a means to try and multiply the effect of an open policy, whether that is containing the Soviet Union or countering terrorism. Covert action is one tool which can be used alongside others. And I'm just going to briefly, for the next 5 minutes or so, before I get on to Britain specifically, just outline the state of the literature at the moment, because there are a few books and articles come out over the last year or so talking about different reasons why states choose to use covert means of intervention as opposed to overt. And many of these apply to the UK just as they apply to the United States. So the first one, DC, please, is it's used to override constraints. It is, and these constraints are threefold. They can be military constraints, if the state is not militarily powerful enough to go to war, then covert action might be a appealing alternative. They can be political constraints, if a state doesn't have the political capacity to go to war because people are war weary and don't want more boots on the ground, covert action can again become an appealing alternative. And for Britain, one of the reasons, one of the big political constraints, which prime ministers used covert action to navigate, was accusations of neo-imperialism. In the era of decolonization, Britain could no longer keep meddling openly in the affairs of Africa, the Near East, Middle East, Southeast Asia. So prime ministers turned to covert action. And then a third constraint is economic. Leaders often choose, rightly or wrongly, to use covert action because they see it as a cheaper alternative. And for these reasons, covert action is appealing. It has long been much more appealing to people in the White House and in Downing Street than it has been to the actual agencies who are tasked to carry it out. In Britain, at least, successive prime ministers have seen covert action as a magic bullet to resolve their problems in a quiet and discreet manner, but it doesn't always quite work out that way. Next slide, please. Secondly, states choose to use covert action to try and avoid escalation. And this works in two ways. On one hand, states might choose to use it in as in the Cold War, in a nuclear weapon scenario where overt intervention is too dangerous and risks escalation to military confrontation and ultimately to a nuclear strike potentially. But it also works, and this is where recent research by Professor Austin Carson from Chicago has been really, really interesting. It also works in preventing escalation by almost, as Carson calls it, operating backstage, where states know that the other state is using covert action and they use it to signal policy preferences. But because it's unacknowledged, there's less pressure for leaders to respond in an escalatory manner. So that covert action is exposed doesn't necessarily mean that it has failed, because it can still signal policy preferences and prevent escalation to a more overt military conflict. The third one, please, DC. It can shield from audience costs, from domestic audience costs. It can override criticism from the public about having boots on the ground, going back to a point I made earlier. And then fourth and finally, please, DC. And this comes from recent work by Michael Posnansky at Pittsburgh, and he argues that leaders choose to use covert action when there is a lack of legal exemption from non-intervention. So leaders are more likely to pursue secrecy when they lack a legal exemption from the non-intervention principle, such as self-defense or authorization from an international body. So states choose to use covert action when they can't do it legally, overtly. And I just think it's worth remembering that when we think about covert action, because it is a policy choice. But let's move on to the UK for the next 20 minutes or so. The UK does it too. When we talk about covert action, we do tend to think of the Americans. But Britain's talked of covert action since 1945. We have an Intelligence Services Act of 1994, which authorizes the intelligence services to engage in other tasks beyond intelligence gathering. But there's no definition. It's flexible, it's vague, there's less written down. And somebody once said to me, who knows about this stuff, said that for MI6, covert action is simply intelligence doing stuff. Intelligence doing stuff. And I guess that's alluding to shaping and interfering, but it just shows how hazy and how ill-defined British approaches to covert action are. And that's very deliberate. The vagueness increases the room for maneuver which Britain has. It's done by function rather than action. It's done by function rather than actor. So it can be done by SIS, by special forces. It has been done in the past by military deception actors. Britain would class various parts of deception as covert action. It's been done by the Foreign Office, who were in charge of British propaganda during the Cold War. And increasingly now, it's done by GCHQ, Britain's Signals Intelligence Agency. So a lot of different actors can engage in this. It's supposed to be flexible, so we can respond quickly without too much bureaucratic wrangling. And from my research into the history of British covert action, I've tried to distill five key principles, which I'll run through now, which I think constitutes a British way in covert action, a British approach. And the first one, if you wouldn't mind clicking, please, DC, is about trying to maintain a defensive position or the status quo. Britain chose to use covert action in an attempt to mask decline and to maintain a global role. As Britain was in decline after the Second World War, a big gap opened up between British responsibilities or perceived responsibilities and dwindling British capabilities. And successive prime ministers saw covert action as a means of hiding this gap resolving it, if not able to resolve it, then hiding this gap. And they also sought to protect Britain's image by doing things covertly. Now, even the most offensive covert operations which Britain undertook were framed very much as defensive. So even things like trying to overthrow the Albanian government in the late 1940s, Britain understood that not as a liberation operation, but as trying to defend Allied forces during the Greek Civil War. When Britain helped overthrow Prime Minister Mossadegh in 1953 in Iran. That was understood not as an offensive operation, but was understood very much as defending Britain's regional influence in the face of a nationalist challenge. So throughout British history, Britain's never used covert action to gain territory. It's only, this is how it's justified anyway, it's only tried to use covert action to maintain the existing status quo, to prevent loss of influence, to prevent decline. And if you click, please, DC. And this is why Britain's always framed it as counterattack. And Britain's had various covert action strategies over the year. In 1948, for example, they had something called the defensive-offensive approach. In 1955, they had something called counter-subversion, which used covert action to defend against challenges of communism and nationalist subversion. In the 1970s, covert action against terrorists in Northern Ireland was talked of as counter-action. And in fact, Britain has never done propaganda, ever. If you look at the British files, never ever has Britain done propaganda. What Britain has done a lot of is counter-propaganda. You'll never see them admitting to propaganda, but they'll do counter-propaganda, even though in practice they seem quite similar to me. And now there's talk in the Foreign Office and elsewhere of counter-disinformation work. And what we see is, because it's always framed as a counter-attack, because Britain, like other liberal democracies, doesn't want to resort to this as a first response, it means that covert action's always been quite reactionary. It's always tried to muddle through. This can be quite dangerous, because it can lead to a whack-a-mole approach to covert action. But it's through attempts to legitimize covert action in a democracy. But we only do it when another side does it first. Basically, we have to resort to their level, which means it's often quite reactionary and not always as well thought through as it might be. So point number one of Britain's way in propaganda is it's defensive and designed to maintain the status quo. At least that's how Whitehall interpreted it anyway. Point number two, please, DC. Point number two is propaganda. And I think it's wrong generally to understand covert action as paramilitary and guns. This is the stuff which generates the most headlines, because it's hardest to keep secret and it's the most dynamic and obvious. But in reality, it forms only a tiny proportion of a state's covert action. And Britain is no exception here. The bulk of British covert action since 1945 has been about influence operations. And what Britain has done is use propaganda as a cornerstone of covert action to enable other more kinetic and more controversial forms of covert action to be successful. The aim is not dissimilar to how Britain's and the West adversaries use propaganda. The aim, this I think is fairly universal, is to exploit divisions. To exploit divisions and to exploit fissures in society. It's about trying to drive a wedge between governments and people, between countries, between different target groups within the same country. It's about trying to create a wedge and then exploit those divisions. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Next slide, please. In the 1940s, propaganda was providing its own attack on communism, but was used in conjunction with economic operations to try and disrupt Czechoslovakian industry, for example. And propaganda worked hand in hand with deception operations, with sabotage in the 1940s. One of the most odd files I saw when researching this related to the 1956 Hungarian Revolution. And it was a file from a foreign office written a couple of years after the revolution. And it basically said, and I don't know how far it went, if they actually approved it or not, but the idea was to, the diplomats were moaning that the propaganda benefits of the Soviet suppression of the Hungarian uprising were wearing off because it was a couple of years ago and people were kind of forgetting how brutal the Soviets were. And diplomats were wondering whether they could somehow provoke some more Soviet repression post-Hungary in order to be used in propaganda. And I don't know if that ever happened, but we see that propaganda is often was often understood in conjunction with other types of operations. Propaganda was never, or very rarely, was an end in itself. In 1950s, the overthrow of Mossadegh in 53 obviously happened in August 53, but the British propaganda campaign started in 1951, and it shows how long it takes to lay the groundwork and soften up targets and create the right atmosphere for a coup to take place. So Britain saw propaganda as a longer term background constant to divide, discredit, exploit, and ultimately enable other forms of covert action or indeed other means of policy execution to have a have an effect. We think about British covert action against Egypt in the 1950s as involving outlandish attempts to try and assassinate the president Nasser, and famous stories of poisoned chocolates and poison gas being put into his ventilation system in his palace, or at least they wanted to do that. And in reality, all of this was underpinned by constant propaganda. It formed the backbone of Britain's anti-Nasser operations, just like during longer counter-terrorism campaigns in the 1970s and 19 in Ireland. Propaganda again forms the backbone of broader operations. Ireland's an interesting point because it raised a dilemma of do we use grey covert propaganda in Northern Ireland against British citizens? And we saw the Foreign Office trying to justify, legitimise their decision to use this form of covert action against British citizens. And it was so controversial that the Foreign Office said, well, we can use it because it's not really British citizens. We're linking it to Ireland. It's influenced by Ireland. Second, we can justify it because they're infiltrated by communists and therefore they fall under our remit here because they could potentially have links to communist parties in Europe and indeed the Soviet Union. And most outlandishly of all, they tried to justify using covert propaganda in Ireland by playing up the Vatican City angle. They said this, you know, this is this 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 has foreign this has potential foreign sponsorship, foreign links, and therefore we can justify it. So Britain used propaganda a lot, but they knew that it was a bit underhand and would constantly try and frame it and try and legitimize it around either self-defense or around, self-defense and the idea that adversaries started it. So the second point in our British way is propaganda as a backbone of British covert action, as a background constant. Point number three, please. Point number three is caution. Classic British caution. Even the bigger operations, the overthrow of Enver Hoxha, who we see on the picture here in Albania, or the attempted overthrow, started off as very, very small pilot schemes. In Albania, for example, MI6 started simply by using covert action to gather intelligence in this odd blurring of two sides of secret activity, intelligence gathering and covert action. They used covert action to gather intelligence on the ripeness of conditions for a revolution without actually going ahead and doing that or attempting that revolution. They then sought simply to disrupt supply lines going from Albania to the communists in the Greek Civil War. Same for Operation Boot, the overthrow of Mossadegh. It started very, very small scale in 1951, and that's how Britain's often thought about covert action. It's about disrupting, or at least trying to disrupt adversaries. And this started, next slide, please. This can be seen as early as the late 1940s. This is Stuart Mingus, who was ahead of MI6 in the war and afterwards. And he was one of the architects of Britain's counter-Soviet covert action for the next 20 years. And it was essentially disruptive. It was about trying to undermine Soviet authority, trying to just gradually chip away, to prod, to poke, to discredit, not to overthrow, but just to make life difficult, instigating go slow campaigns, for example, in factories. Even things that were really sound really quite silly, including particularly ridiculously planting stink bombs in Communist Party meetings, was discussed, again to try and disrupt, to try and undermine credibility and authority. In the 1950s, the Foreign Secretary called for MI6 to disrupt anti-British activities at source. And since then, British covert action has been used to disrupt Egyptian subversive bases in Yemen, to disrupt Indonesian military activity against Malaysia, to disrupt supply routes feeding the Omani insurgency in the 1970s, to disrupt terrorist activity in Northern Ireland, and in Uruguay and in Lebanon, to disrupt Soviet activity in Afghanistan. This is a constant theme of British covert action. It's small and it's designed to disrupt our adversaries. If you wouldn't mind clicking, please, DC. And this is Alex Younger, one of Stuart Mingus's successors, the current chief of SIS, and he uses almost the exact same language as Mingus did and as foreign secretaries did in the 1950s. He's talking about disrupting terrorists through covert action. He talks about MI6 being an upstream service which aims to keep the enemy, as he puts it, keeps the enemy in their half of the pitch. Now, this is remarkably similar to a remark made by Harold Macmillan, the Foreign Secretary in the 1950s, about disrupting anti-British activities at source. So we see a remarkable continuity from disrupting Soviets in the 40s all the way through to disrupting terrorists in the last 5 years or so. So point number three in of our 5 points of British covert action is caution and disruption. Next slide, please. Point number four is Britain, I guess, as an extension of caution, always trying to maximize deniability. It led to a very indirect approach. And I'll give you an example. This picture here is the Iraqi leader, Nuri al-Said, from the 1950s. And when Britain wanted to overthrow the Syrian government in the 1950s, it could have covertly organized a coup itself. It decided against it. It took an indirect approach and tried to incite Iraq to organize a coup against Syria instead. And the outcome was, when it failed, Britain escaped a lot of the blame, and the Syrians remembered that particular coup plot as the Iraqi plot. So we see a lot of quite Machiavellian and cynical attempts to work through allies and to facilitate other people's actions, to create conditions which might be conducive to a coup in places like Syria, in places like Iran, without getting their hands too dirty in trying to covertly organize that coup themselves. So they look for regional partners. And this is they're quite explicit about doing this in the archival files. Again, because the Brits like to see themselves as fair players. in international relations. They didn't want to get their hands dirty, so they sacrificed a bit of control for the sake of anonymity. Next slide, please. This extended most controversially to assassination, where Britain does not do assassination. It has no track record of assassination to speak of. What it has done is colluded with friendly partners and created conditions where a certain person who they wouldn't have mind being assassinated ended up getting assassinated. And there are I haven't got time to go into it, but there's a surprising number of examples of this happening back in 1950s in Iran, attempts with Nasser in the 1950s. Going through, I'll give you one quick example from 1955. The SIS officer in Saigon wanted to kill Ho Chi Minh, and Britain does not do assassination. So his plan was to try to start a row within the Hanoi Politburo, which would then spark a chain of events leading to the assassination of the North Vietnamese president, Ho Chi Minh. So we see a very baroque plan. And a similar thinking happened regarding, as the picture on the screen, Patrice Lumumba, the first democratically elected leader of the Congo. Britain was not involved in the assassination directly, but it did help through a series of covert operations conducted in conjunction with the CIA. It helped create a climate in which Lumumba was eventually killed. And most famously, Britain has been accused of colluding with loyalist paramilitary groups in Northern Ireland in the killing of various Republican figures. So this kind of maximum deniability is something which Britain's often striven for. Next slide, please. So we like to work through allies, and I think it's worth seeing a couple of things on the Anglo-American relationship here, given that I'm talking to a lot of American friends and colleagues. Britain has, or both sides, have misled the other on covert action, manipulated the other, tried to recruit the other, and have restrained the other. Britain actively tried to recruit America in Iran, in Syria, in Yemen. America actively tried to recruit Britain in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And there's lots of competition and conflict. The orthodox narrative is that America had the money, Britain had the expertise, and that's how the relationship developed. But as early as 1948, 1949, the Americans and the Brits were really annoying each other. And the Brits and the Americans both thought each other were useless at covert action in Albania, for example. Hence, they developed an approach of policy coordination, but operational disengagement. Britain actively tried to manipulate the Americans over Iran and boasted about it in the files. But despite these various disagreements, Britain has long been keen to work with America because covert action is one of the very few areas, or intelligence generally is one of the very few areas where Britain still has a little bit of leverage in an otherwise very asymmetric relationship. And also Britain likes to try and work with America to try and restrain America, or like Britain likes to think it can anyway, to restrain America if they think America's going too far. But one thing I found very interesting from the files is that quite often in the 50s and the 60s, America was trying to restrain Britain. America thought British covert action was going too far. Okay, fifth slide, please. Fifth and finally. Policy integration. I won't dwell on this because it's a bit bureaucratic, but basically to say that Britain constantly, from World War II onwards, tried to make sure that covert action was properly integrated in the Foreign Office. So we're not talking about rogue elephants. We're not talking about separate agencies going off doing crazy stuff. The overwhelming majority of British covert action was signed off properly by the Foreign Secretary. And there are various debates within that, and I haven't got time to go into them. But I think that's a core point which Britain continually tried to emphasize, was ensuring that covert action became almost a routine part of foreign policy, especially in the 50s and 60s. It was normalized, it was integrated, to try and make sure that it multiplied, or if it was a force multiplier for standard open means of policy execution. So to close, let's just think about success. Did it work? Next slide, please. It's very, very difficult to measure success in covert action because the goals shift. The goals are quite vague, so it's hard to measure outcomes against the goals. Even in the American case, after presidential findings came in, if you look at the actual findings, the goals are still very vague, so it's hard to even take a very rationalist or instrumentalist approach and measure success by outcomes against goals, because goals are very vague. You then have the classic short-term versus long-term trade-off. You have, I think, a particularly difficult, particular problem trying to measure success is isolating the agency of the particular covert action. How do we know that something which happened because of the covert action? And there's a danger of overplaying the Western hand and undermining internal agency. And scholars are starting to write about this in Chile, for example, in Italy. How do we know that the CIA made all the difference? So it's very, very difficult to judge success. But I'll just finish by having a little attempt anyway, on the British side at least. Next slide, please. So it's hard to judge. And also because there's a lot of bluster from people who want to do covert action and sometimes even misrepresent what they've been authorized to do in the archival records. So it's very difficult to know what Britain did, what was authorized, and what actually happened. But with those rather large caveats aside, Britain has a mixed record. It's seen some successes in Iran. It's seen successes in Indonesia in the 1960s when it used covert action as part of confrontation. It's seen success in the 1970s in Oman when it used covert action to try and quell an insurgency and to intervene across the border in South Yemen. Notable failure is obviously Albania in the late 1940s. And then there are slightly more ambivalent things, like in the 1960s, Britain fought a covert war against Yemen. But whether it's a success or not ultimately comes down to judgment because, yes, this covert war in Yemen tied down the enemy for a long time, particularly it tied down the Egyptian president Nasser, who was supporting one side in the civil war. So some people saw it as a success. But then it didn't prevent withdrawal from the British colony of Aden in 1967. And there's also intangible successes. I think British covert action has been successful in the context of the Anglo-American relationship and also in the context of other alliances with countries around the world. But I think we can say with more certainty that success in covert action, and this isn't just specific to Britain, it depends on a couple of things. It depends on integration into policy. When it's competing against other policies, it's a recipe for disaster. I think it depends on it being coordinated and having clear objectives. So it can't be, covert action is very susceptible to mission creep. I think its success depends on it building on existing movements. You're not going to create a dissident group from scratch. But as I said a few minutes ago, that makes judging success quite tricky, because how do we separate external from internal agency? And it also depends on intelligence assessments of the nature of the proxy or the third party you're supporting. And the Britain was very cynical, might be the wrong word, realistic might be another word, in when choosing which proxies to support with covert action, and they asked their intelligence bodies to find out A, if this third party had a hope in hell's chance of winning, and if they didn't, there's no point in spending political capital on them. And more bluntly, were these third parties, these tribal groups, were they willing to die for their cause? And that's something which intelligence had to work out, because quite ruthlessly, I suppose, more senior policymakers were not willing to use covert action to support people who were not, to put it bluntly, willing to die for their cause. So Britain's had a mixed record over the years, although it's very difficult to judge. And then DC, please. And that was my final slide, which leaves, I make it, 19 minutes for questions. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Cormack. At this time, let's go ahead and we'll open up for any discussions, and I will do my best to address the questions in the chat. From Dr. Drumhiller, do you see a difference in the public's response to covert action when comparing U.S. and British approaches?
I think the public know less about British approaches, because Britain's been long been more what's the words the British press has been less willing to expose operations. Secrecy has been a much British operations have managed to stay secret more so than American operations, is what I'm trying to say. So I think there's fewer there's less public debate anyway, and I think that in Britain, the public, when it does come out, and this isn't just covert action, but intelligence more broadly, the British public kind of shrugs its shoulders and thinks, yeah, that's okay. That's the kind of thing we expect our intelligence agencies to do. We don't really need to know about this. We trust the government to do what's right for the country. And we don't want another war anyway. So if they think that covert action is the right way to go, then that's okay. And so when we do see examples of covert action failure coming into the public consciousness quite vividly, it doesn't really raise that many eyebrows. I mean, an example recently I can think of was, it's not that recent now, we're getting old, during the Arab Spring in 2011, when an MI6 and Special Forces team landed in a helicopter in Libya to make contact with the rebels and quickly got arrested, and the whole thing was an absolute disaster. But no one in Britain really cared, and I think there's a couple of reasons for this. One is there's just general more trust of intelligence services more broadly, and perhaps even more trust of the government. And I think the Bond myth also helps in shaping British public's attitudes towards intelligence, to the extent that when you do find out something outrageous and you go to a news producer or a journalist and say, like, I've got a story, I found something. One producer once said to me, well, none of this is that's not as exciting as what Bond does. And British public think that Bond, the Bond's real anyway. So your revelation from the archives isn't going to hold water against public expectation. So I think those factors shape British debate about covert action in a way that seems to be people be less interested than in America.
As a follow-up point, Dr. Drumhiller says that's interesting, given the media exposure in the U.S. and is all the rage, and showing the sensitivities to that. Our next question comes from Ruben. Dr. Cormack, could you make some comments on plausible and unplausible deniability?
Hi, Ruben. Of course I can, with great pleasure. This stems from an article which Professor Richard Aldrich and I wrote in International Affairs last year. And we argued that this idea of plausible deniability is actually a bit of a myth. And when you look back, even at the early Cold War, even at the heyday of covert action, Deniability was never plausible, and it's only got less plausible. So what we think is that actually covert action is about unacknowledged interventionism rather than plausibly deniable interventionism. But we argue that this doesn't necessarily mean the end of covert action, because one of the points that that certain scholars make when they look at the end of the Cold War is that, well, covert action is going to die out because of a decrease in secrecy. Covert action is a dying art form. But we think that actually, one, secrecy has never been that great anyway in certain operations, particularly paramilitary operations. And two, that does not necessarily mean the end of covert action, because states are willing to embrace implausible deniability because, one, it can signal policy preferences. It's exposed, but it's not acknowledged. And that exposure is essential in signaling discontent, in signaling preferences, in signaling deterrence. So exposure is necessary for certain types of covert action. It also, the implausible deniability also helps create confusion and create ambiguity and make it difficult for to know when and how to respond. And we see this, for example, in some of Putin's operations over the last few years. Everybody knows that Putin was behind attempts to interfere in the electoral system in America, attempted assassination of Skripal in the UK, and obviously in Ukraine. But the lack of acknowledgement and the implausibility and the ambiguity all blurs the line between between external intervention and internal disorder, between legitimate and illegitimate activity. And it's almost like salami slicing. You don't quite know when the red line's been crossed to know when and how to intervene. Kind of the cyber attacks on the Baltics, it's just poking and testing NATO and an Article 5. And I think for a variety of reasons, therefore, that just because it is exposed and therefore is implausibly deniable does not mean that the operation has the covert action has failed, because implausible covert action has strategic logic in its own right. It sends a message. Look at again the Skripal case. The assassination of Skripal failed. B, everyone knows that it was the Russians who tried to do it. But through that, he sent a message, and the message is to other potential defectors and former Russian Soviet intelligence officers, saying, you know, don't defect. There is this, they're sending a message, and you can't send a message if it is actually secret and actually deniable.
Thank you. Any other questions for Dr. Cormick? Well, certainly we do appreciate your coming and talking to us today. Any last calls for any questions before we wrap it up for today? Rory, we want to thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come and talk to us and present some information on covert action and your results of your research, and we certainly appreciate your time doing that. If there's nothing
Absolute pleasure.
else, we'll wrap it up for today, and I want to thank everybody for coming, and again, thank you, Dr. Cormick, for your particular presentation and your time to share with us today.
Thank you,
That's
and
it,
thanks for having me.
everybody. Dr. Drumheller will be sending out additional notes on next month's presentation. And for that, everybody have a great day, and thanks for coming. Bye now.